say we're going to start very broad. I don't know how much experience you folks have had with genomics or computer-based programs to do genomic-type research. If you were doing things, BLAST, and those programs sound familiar. BLAST, GeneMapper. No? All right. So maybe some of you may have some, but a lot of it may be new. So if any of this is not clear, please help me ask questions. A lot of it is very visually based. And so if you don't understand the pictures, please be sure to ask me. A lot of it will make sense. So we're going to start with today talking about structural genomics. And then the next lecture will be on functional genomics, actually using all the information that you get from structural genomics and how you actually apply it out. But today will just be structural, how do you gain all this information. So what I mean when I say the word genomics, what does that mean? So I just don't want to add here.
Does it take after the word genome, which is all the genes in a system?
That's right. That's right. So genomics really is a takeoff of the word genome. So and a genome is all the genes found in a particular organism. So a genome in the organism is all the coding material for that organism. So genomics is really the study of all of the genes in an organism. Right, so that includes looking at functions, interactions. The thing that makes it genomics is that it's all of the genes. So you're looking very globally. So a lot of what we talked about in genetics, when we say make a mutant, we're looking very specifically, right, at function of a single gene. But for genomics, we're looking much more broadly. And in fact, the creation of the field of genomics has led to a new vocabulary in science. Some of these words you've probably heard. So, transcriptome. What's a transcriptome? Heard that word before?
Yes.
Okay, so it would be basically be the expression profile or the mRNA profile of the genes, all the genes in the genome. So you said that you're going to look at the transcriptome of a bug, and then you're going to look to see what genes are being expressed and at what level in the condition. Proteome would be the
all the proteins in the organism?
Thank you. That's right. So all the proteins. So the proteome would be looking at all the proteins that are being expressed and at what level in an organism. Secretome? Everybody's tongue going from the exam 2 days ago. One thing that's affected.
Yes.
Secretome. Right. So looking for all the products that are going to be secreted. And then virion would be looking at virulence factors, so looking for virulence factors in the organism. And metabolome would be the metabolic products in the organism. And there are various other types of omaker, olome, terminology that are appearing in the literature quite often. So that all of this vocabulary and these types of sciences were fueled by the fact that genomics was actually created. In terms of thinking very broadly about why people are interested in this, here's a pretty broad list of things you can think about. So obviously, by definition, it's going to give a comprehensive list of all the genes, and then that information can be applied, and we'll talk about some of the different types of applications that you can use for that. Right? So you can think about it that it really gives a foundation by which you can start to put genes into broad functional groups, gives a type of classification system, and it tells us something about genomic organization. Why might we care about how the genes are organized in the chromosome?
Because
Maybe because we can see which way they interact with each other, like in the operon.
So you can make predictions about expression, whether or not they're in your operon. Often in bacteria, components that might interact or are in similar pathways are encoded close to each other. They may often be kind of very close to each other, which is very different than you might find in eukaryotic systems. That doesn't hold as true in bacteria. Often, things that are related are close together in the genome. Right? So that's an important value to understand. It also can tell us something about the evolution of bacteria in terms of thinking about how different species are related to each other. So you can make comparisons, say, to E. coli, Salmonella, or to Shigella, which are very related, and ask what's changed that's actually led to the evolution of this different type of bacteria. So understanding the organization of the genes that are missing can help with that, or what's present. You can also identify families and how those are distributed between different types of bacteria. Why might that be important in terms of thinking about the genes that might fall into this last function? So thinking about housekeeping genes and things that might be specific to certain types of bacteria. So why might we care from a med micro perspective? So if you have a certain set of core genes that's only found in certain bacteria, those could be good targets for antibiotic therapy, development of novel antibiotics, etc. But if you don't know how widely distributed those are, it may not be as good of a target. Right? So understanding what's novel can help out. So then in terms of actual application of the data, some of these things we just talked about. So often it's really good in pathogenesis, and you'll probably be reading papers along the way where people actually do strain comparisons between different pathogenic organisms. They do what we would call genomic comparisons, right? So basically you ask what's in one bacterium that's not in the other, or lost in one bacterium as compared to another. And how does that affect virulence? Right? We just mentioned the fact that it's good for thinking about development of antimicrobials, but it can also be important for thinking about antimicrobial resistance, whether certain genes have been obtained from the environment or from other organisms that encode resistance factors. What about specific markers for identification of typing? Why do we care about that?
Well, in cancer research, they're currently trying to identify markers, right?
Right, why? Why do we care?
So that we can show that cancer is present, even if it's not visible to naked eye.
All right, so having some sensitive thing that we can detect for disease might help us find out that the disease is there before we know about it. So that's right. That's a good example. What about for bacteria? Why do we care? Right. So if you know what the infection is, and there's a very simple way to find that out without having to wait for a culture, then you can treat immediately as a physician. So these things probably should be pretty evident if you think about what's happened within you guys' immediate lifetime. You think about 9/11 and anthrax and spores. So they spend a lot of time now trying to develop a very quick way to detect whether or not something is anthrax or not, right? So because just looking at spores, you can't tell that. So by finding genes that are only encoded in Bacillus anthracis, you can detect the presence of those genes, and so then you can have a very sensitive way of detecting it. Right? It's very, very straightforward application. You can also think about epidemiological studies. So in terms of microorganisms, by looking for genes that might be encoded in that organism that you might show are associated with disease. So a lot of epidemiological studies have been done asking, what about this population and this particular strain of the bacterium that's infecting leads to a higher risk of disease? For instance, with Helicobacter pylori, it's been shown that there's a virulence factor called Tag A, which if the strain of bacterium carries that, then a person that's infected is about 4 to 10 times more likely to develop severe disease, meaning ulcers and gastric cancer. So there's something about the presence of that gene that predisposes towards severe disease. So having a broad look at the genome helps to identify those types of factors. All right, and then we mentioned targets that can also be broadly not only antimicrobials, but vaccines themselves. And then obviously finding things that are unique to bacteria, because we want to target things that aren't found in our own cells. Go with the tenets of selective toxicity. All right, so then when we think about genomics, really its foundation started with the creation of technologies that allowed us for the first time to sequence entire genomes. So that's happened, you know, within the last 15 to 20 years, and the advances in that have been pretty amazing in terms of how that all happens, how do you sequence. And so what I thought we might do is we might spend some time talking about actually how sequencing projects are done. And we'll start with the origination of how people determine sequence, and then we'll talk about the newer technologies, which are a lot faster, less expensive, and a lot easier to use. Alright? So, the first sequencing that really came into popular utilization and really helped us for the first time understand the content of genes is called dideoxy terminator sequencing. It's also known as Sanger sequencing. Have you folks heard of this before? You covered biochemistry, probably, right? All right. So then we won't spend much time on it, but I want to remind you that for the reactions, then what you would need would be a primer, you'd need nucleotides, the polymerase, and in this example, you need something to label. So here I said radionucleotides. So that's typically what you use, but not always. Right. In the original way it was designed, it was. And it relies upon the fact that you have this dideoxynucleotide. So since it's dideoxy, it can't be elongated. So you get premature termination of the extension of the sequence. Right. So the polymerase adds that nucleotide, and then it terminates because you're missing that hydroxyl group that you require for the addition of the next nucleotide in that linkage. So if you look at that here, what we can see is that we wanted to sequence this strand of DNA. So we have some kind of labeled primer, and that would add, and it would anneal, and it would extend. In this case, we'd added dideoxy ATP. So every time a dideoxy ATP would stop, you would terminate the reaction. So what you would end up with is various lengths of DNA fragment that, because they're radio labeled, we can then separate out on a sequence genome and actually visualize where those are. So you can imagine that if you had four separate tubes where you had DDATP or the other three nucleotides, etc., then you could basically get a ladder type effect. So you can then read the sequence. And I'll show you a picture of that. So in terms of thinking about the dideoxynucleotide itself, it would look something like this. And the important change is here. So normally there would be a hydroxyl group found there, and that's replaced in the dideoxy, which is hydrogenated. And so that's the biochemistry behind how dideoxy sequencing functions. So it's four separate reactions, a four-tube reaction. And fortunately, that picture didn't come out, but it's represented here. So then you had a tube where each of these represented the particular dideoxy nucleotide. You could separate on a sequencing gel, the individual components, and you get this laddering effect. And so then you could read the sequence by just simply reading up the different sizes. So you know, here would be C, G, A, A, T. Right? And it's because it terminated at that particular point in that dideoxynucleotide was inserted. Does that make sense to everyone? Right. So it's separated at the base pair resolution, or the base resolution. And so, yes?
So you depend on button for that?
Well, it depends upon which strand you're sequencing off of. So you have to know where your primer is going to kneel. So if you're sequencing 5' to 3' or 3' to 5', that would affect how you do the sequence. So, what this entails, obviously, when it was originally developed, was the use of radionucleotides and the use of sequencing gels, which to actually get base pair resolution, you have to pour incredibly thin sequencing gels. They're about a millimeter thick, so they're very, very difficult to actually set up and pour. And a standard sequencing gel is a really large gel, so it's really very difficult and awkward to work with. So you have very large glass plates. And those are actually the small ones. So in areas where there were poor facilities that were doing sequencing, they would have, you know, plates that went from here to the ground that they would afford to do sequencing reactions. Because the further you can run, the more bases you can get from their actual resolution. You have to separate them by a single base difference. So that size requires a long time to actually get that difference. Mm-hmm. It's so very complicated, very time-consuming, and you have to use radionucleotides, which some people don't like to do. All right? So actually, here's a picture of what one of those sequencing gels would look like. So here, every four lanes would represent the sequence of one piece of DNA. And so it would be common to run a sequencing gel that looked like this, and then you would have to read every four lanes in an individual sequence, and then assemble that. So, and these were read manually. You put the piece of film, so this would be a piece of actually photographic film that was exposed, and so the black marks are where the radioactive nucleotide had exposed. So you'd actually put that in the light box and then read it by eye. It's a very time consuming, very difficult. You imagine it would take a long time to do this type of sequencing and sequence the entire human genome, right? All right, so we transitioned from that, and there were different things that, different technologies that were developed that actually helped to make sequencing a lot better and actually helped fuel the genomic revolution, as it's been called. So some of that had to do with the development of other types of labeling systems that could be used. So people moved away from using radioactivity and began to use fluorescent dyes. And the original fluorescent dyes that were developed it would be a single dye, but that dye could be attached to, it could be different colored dyes that could be attached to the different bases. So then by looking at the color of the dye that was found, you could detect which base was being added. And so you would do, once again, four separate reactions, and then those could be combined and run in a single lane. But you would get something that would look like this. So now, rather than having to read four lanes for a sequence, you could read a single lane based upon the color. You would know which base had been added or where the termination could occur. And then after that, there was more sophisticated systems that came along where that still relied on different dyes, but now it was a one-tube reaction. And so that helped a lot because now you go from four times as much material to a single tube. Right? And then the latest revolutions have come, and you will likely hear, read in the literature the words either pyrosequencing or 454 sequencing. And these rely on really sequencing by synthesis. And these have made the ability to sequence a genome pretty phenomenal and cheap. So you actually sequence as you basically do a PCR type reaction, you're actually sequencing the genome as you go along. So you can get very high numbers of reads and you can get, it's very cheap to do. So for instance, I'm part of a group that has just sequenced a new strain of flu for that group. And we did that for about $25,000, where used to would have cost probably $100,000 to $150,000, right? So it's much cheaper now. And that's why you're starting to see the appearance of many more human genomes. Right? You folks noticed that in the past year, there have been, I think, one or two more human genomes that have been published. Anybody know who Craig Venter is? Craig Venter? It's a big name in genomics. So Craig Venter actually sequenced himself this past year. So we see in science fiction movies these like Gattaca, you take a hair and you put it in and then you back the sequence of someone. So that's really, we used to laugh 5-10 years ago when that movie came out, but this person sequenced himself this year. He used his company to come up with his own DNA sequence. And that's important because it allows us to compare human sequences amongst each other. So it's these types of sequencing techniques that have come out in the last few years that really allowed that to happen. So what you're going to see is you're going to start to see a lot more genomic sequences out there. And we'll talk about some of the statistics about what is available out there right now. All right, so let's talk about the technical things that come into this. So that's really biochemistry behind how the reactions are done. But let's say you're in the lab and you want to sequence your favorite organism, whatever that might be. So let's talk about it in terms of probably prokaryotic systems, because that'll be a lot simpler. So let's say you've got your favorite bug and you want to sequence. What's the first thing you're going to need? What's that? DNA, that's right. So you want to know what the genomic sequence is, so you're going to need DNA. How are you going to get DNA? You're going to extract it. So what does that require? So broadly, means you have to be able to...
Well, you need to put the DNA into a solution and break down the cells, but not break down the DNA.
So there are techniques to do that for pretty much all organisms. So that's probably not a challenge. But you've got to be able to grow a whole lot of your organism, right? And so you've got to be able to get a sufficient amount of DNA. And so we'll talk a little bit about the fact that's not possible with all microorganisms at this stage, right? So it has to be culturable. You have to be able to grow it in sufficient quantities to get enough DNA to actually be able to then use for sequencing. And so you might hear in the literature the word shotgun sequencing. Right? So this used to be the way that pretty much all genomes were made. They were made by, or compiled, and they were done by shotgun sequencing. Right? And so shotgun refers to the fact that really what you do is that you take the chromosome, you shear it in some way, whether that be manually by sonication or using restriction enzyme that's going to cut it a certain place. And that happens fairly randomly. And then those small pieces of DNA get cloned into a vector, which you can then move into E. coli and then produce a lot of that DNA. And then you can then sequence specifically from that vector to see what you've inserted. All right? So then what you're going to come up with is a large number of very relatively small reads of DNA that you can then assemble into contigs. Heard the word contig? So into contiguous pieces of DNA, and then you can basically assemble the entire piece of DNA. Right? And we'll actually, I don't think my picture's translated. So maybe we'll put the board up and actually draw what visually mean by all this. Right, you need them to overlap. So the contig is going to be a large read through, but you have to have sequences that overlap. You're not going to get them together. All right. Let's. So if you think about this as the chromosome, so then you're going to chop this up in some way so that you have small pieces. Okay. And if you did this with a particular restriction enzyme that had a particular cut site, you would know what the end is. And so that might facilitate cloning into a vector that had been cut with a similar restriction enzyme, right? So you can get directional cloning. Or, so it would be I would say, overlap cloning, not necessarily directional. You could do it directional and cut with two enzymes. Right, so you can clone it into this vector. Right, and so then what you would end up with is a whole bunch of these vectors that each contain a different piece of DNA. And then you could set up your sequencing reaction. Alright, so let's start this with the red piece here being the random fragment. So then where would you put your primer? How would you design your primer? So what's a good scenario? Where would it lie in this piece of material? Right, so you can sequence off either strand off of the vector, or maybe both strands of the vector to get a double read. Right? And so then what you would end up with your output sequence is you would have sequence of a piece of the vector, sequence of your insert, and then one again sequence of the vector. Right? So this allows the use of a universal primer, so the same primer or primers for every sequence you read. Right? So that's important. And so then you're going to end up with all of these different fragments of DNA that are all going to have the same little region. So you're going to have lots of them. Okay. And so then you need to ask, well, does this piece of sequence overlap with this piece of sequence? So you have to take all of these little reads and basically put them together. And so what people did is they established criteria for the amount of overlap that you wanted to put it together. So realistically, as you start to do this, you end up with things that look like this. So where you have overlap, and then each of these, if you took a sequence and read all the way through, it would represent a content. Right? So it's one large piece of DNA that you've assembled from these smaller pieces. So it's a content. So then the goal for any sequencing project for an organism that has one chromosome would be to have one content at the end, because you've sequenced the entire piece. All right, so realistically, for shotgun sequencing, you think you're going to be able to assemble everything? Think you're going to be able to get every gene? So what's required here for this? So we've got a clone reaction. So can anybody think of any, have you folks done cloning? What's the potential problems with cloning? So you're saying that you might get pieces of DNA that might combine out with the vector and you might lose them. It's possible, so let's say, it's possible that these vectors are designed as being very small, so you're probably not going to have a large region, but that's possible. So theoretically, that could be possible. But let's say we've designed a very small, precise, unique vector sequence. It's something else. Okay, so there may be problems with the actual efficiency of the ligation to get pieces inserted. That's possible. So that might be one thing you have to scale up to overcome that. So you have to clone larger pieces or more pieces of DNA and more reactions to be able to bypass that problem, though. But it is something you have to think about. Right. So a major problem with shotgun sequencing is that sometimes foreign pieces of DNA fit into E. coli. So all these plasmids have been moved into E. coli so we can propagate them and make a lot, sometimes maybe lethal. So if you kill your E. coli cells, then you're never going to get that piece of DNA inserted. And so what that's going to end up with is means that in between your contigs, you're going to have large gaps of sequence that you haven't been able to fill in. So what you can then do is if you do have gaps, you can go back and design PCR primers and do try to amplify that region of DNA so you can infer which contigs are close to each other, and then you can sequence the PCR product. So you can basically walk the chromosome and fill in the sequence that you're missing, even though you can't clone all pieces of DNA. Does that make sense? All right, so then if you think about where we are today, and I pulled these numbers just 2 days ago, there is a consortium called the Comprehensive Microbial Resource that you all should be familiar with, and the link to that is webpage for that organization is down at the bottom, and I want you all to spend some time playing around on it, looking at the types of tools that they have there. If there's any of you that work with viruses or bacteria, and even some parasites, you're probably going to end up using this during your graduate course. It's very, very useful. If you ask, what about the numbers? So there are actually 401 organisms whose sequences are found within this CMR, it's called. 384 of those are completed, 17 incomplete, and then here's the breakdown of archaea, viruses, and bacteria. And so 401 organisms is quite a bit of material, but then this actually doesn't even include humans, mice, plants, etc. So there are other types of similar pages out there where people are starting to compile eukaryotic sequences into large data banks. So you can imagine that's an enormous amount of data that's found now in pretty much a few locations. So lots of tools. And in fact, if you go to their homepage, it's something like this. So this used to be Tiger CMR. People heard of Tiger. GIGR, the Institute for Genomic Research. They basically are one of the largest genomics groups in the world and really led the revolution of genomics. Now there are two organizations, so there's Tiger and there's the JCBI, which is basically the Bender Institute. Okay. And here are the types of things that you can find on this. And we're going to walk through some of the tools. There are genomic tools, analysis tools. You can get summary information about either a particular organism that you're interested in, or you can do a global search for certain genes across all the organisms that are contained here. So you can find genes, known sequences. You can actually do comparisons in terms of protein homology, alignments, etc. So I'd like you to spend some time on this website just looking at the types of tools that are available there. Alright, so we talked about the fact that for shotgun sequencing to work, we have to actually be able to culture the organism. So
anybody know how people have been going about getting around this? So I think the estimates are that we've probably been able to sequence about, or to culture about 1% of the microorganisms that are out there. So pretty small numbers. People have been trying to get around this inability to culture either by developing new culture techniques, that's obviously very difficult, time-consuming, or to doing very broad sequencing projects. Once again, the movies didn't translate, but there was a very nice paper that came from the Ventner group that was published in Science in 2004, and basically what they did was shotgun sequencing of the Sargasso Sea. So they basically put down nets that they drug across the sea for a period of weeks. They captured all this material in the nets. They then took all of that material, prepared DNA from it, and shotgun cloned it, and then sequenced it. So, because they had accumulated such a large amount of material, they were able to sequence it. It goes directly without having to grow up a large amount. They weren't trying to complete any one genome. So they weren't looking to see, can we get an entire genome? They were looking to see, are there unique genes? Are there organisms that we don't know about? And so what they found was that there were 1,800 species of bacteria or microbes, and 150 of those were previously unidentified species. And we got 1.2 million new genes. So what that should say to you is that really, in terms of, I'm trying to impress upon you, in fact, in the CMR, there's 401 complete genomes, but really that's nothing compared to the amount of genomic diversity that's around us. So it's pretty amazing when you think about, hey, here in this very simple ocean, which we don't think about a lot of bacteria or things living, they found 1.2 million new genes. So people are doing similar types of projects in different types of soils. In terms of thinking about environmental factors, they're interested in the types of bacteria to grow in areas of large quantities of oil, things like that. So by identifying genes, we can be engineering for modern diagnostics bacteria, right? So we have a lot to learn about what's out there. So we know very little about diversity at this stage. All right, so we talked about the fact that the genes have to be clonable. So really, these 1.2 million genes they found are probably very much an underestimate of the number of genes even in that location, because they only got the ones that could clone. So they were limited by the fact that not all the genes are going to be clonable. Any questions about that? All right, so now we have, let's say we sequence your bug that we started with, that you were interested in. We sequenced the entire thing. So now what are we going to do? You've got 2 million ATGCs. So what does that tell us? Not much. You're right, not much. It says that there are 4 bases in the genome, right? So then what are you going to do with it? Right, so you're going to look for homologs and other sequences, so other organisms that have been sequenced. So you're going to look, try to understand what's going on. And that would be called, a first step called annotation. So you have to annotate the genome, right? So we're going to annotate, meaning that we're going to look for open reading frames, and we're going to try to assign gene functions. That's all part of the annotation, right? And that's, as you said, is based upon homology. You can compare it to other genomes, other genes that have been characterized that we've annotated. So this is an open reading frame map. Have you folks seen these before? You know what they indicate, an open reading frame map? All right, so basically what you would do is that you would take that large piece of sequence that we had, and there are programs you can put it into. This is a program called DNA Strider, and it's going to give you something like this. It's called a warp map. And you can see that there are a total of 6 different lines. So here's a major group, major group, major group, major group, major group. What do you think those might be? You know, from looking, so an open reading frame, what do we mean by open reading frame? Just general. So it's a piece of DNA that has no stop codons contained within it, and so we would predict that it would encode for a protein component, right? So, right. So then, what do you know about proteins in terms of how are proteins made? So you transcribe and then you translate. So then, what does the translation machine look at to decide what amino acid goes into? Codons, right? And a codon is a triplet, right? Right. So then, how many potential reading frames are there in terms of the order reading frames? So there are 6 potential reading frames, right? 3 in the forward direction and 3 in the reverse, right? Depending upon the direction of transcription, which we don't know from this naked piece of DNA, and how the codons are aligned. So, for instance, if we went back here, so ATG might be the first codon, but it might not. It might be TGA or GAA, right? So there are 3 potential frames, +1, +2, and +3. They're plus because they're going in the left to right direction. If you solve the reading frame as -1, -2, or -3, it's just the opposite. It's in the right to left direction. Right? And we don't know that from naked DNA, which direction transcription might be occurring, and also conversely, translation. Alright, so then you can look at that by making an ORF map and asking where are these large contiguous pieces of sequence where we've seen no stop codons, right? And so those would be depicted here by these open boxes, right? So an open box would be a piece of sequence with no stop codons. Stop codons are indicated by a full bar that goes through the box. Okay? So then you can look at this and say, this direction, there is an open reading frame, right? And these are arranged, I believe, with the, definitely are arranged with the plus direction on the top and the minus frame on the bottom, right? So then you've got 1 open reading frame, 2, 3, etc. And then you have some in the opposite direction. The half bars are potential start codons. So what's the start codon? What's the start codon?
Easy question.
Okay, so it's where translation starts, and it's where the formulated methionine gets added. Several of you on your exam seem to think that the +1 and the start codon for translation are the same thing. They're not. Okay? It's very different. Transcription and translation are different. So I just wanted to point that out because they're not the same thing. So these are start codons, so that would be potential start of translation. So for instance, let's look at this open reading frame. So, transcription can start up here, right? But translation may begin down here. Right? So, the +1 is where transcription begins. So, there may be 5' prime untranslated region that never actually becomes protein. Right? So start put on and the plus one is different. That's an important thing you should learn. Alright, so then basically you're going to take the entire sequence of your organism and you're going to do this type of force mapping to look for potential open reading frames. So once you've done this, you're then going to take the open reading frame and you're going to put it into something that looks more like this. So in this case, it's saying here's an open reading frame. Because it was found in the plus frame, it would be transcribed left to right. We can also make predictions about whether or not there would be genes would be arranged into operons. And we would do that by looking for terminator sequences in between. So here you have two open reading frames that are basically separated by a stop codon, but there's no gap in between, right? So there's probably no space to be another promoter sequence. Also realize and remember a stop codon is different than a terminator sequence, right? One controls transcription, the other controls translation. So these are likely transcribed as a single operon, but then translated separately. So then you can make predictions about not only the presence of these open reading frames of these genes, but whether or not they're organized into operons, where terminators would be found, the gaps in between, the directions that transcription occurs. And so once again, that's useful information because, as we said, genes that have similar functions are often either transcribed together or located very close to each other on the chromosome. Any questions about that? No? Makes sense. All right. So let's say that you've now found a predicted open reading frame. And so then the next thing is to look for homologs, right? So we can do that simply by going back and saying, okay, I'm going to take the sequence between here and here, or the translated sequence from, if I want to take nucleotide sequence, or the translated sequence from the start codon forward, and then I'm going to look for homology. This website is actually where this map is found. So it's just a picture of that. This is actually a program. There are probably there's probably freeware you can use to do this. You can just put in a sequence and look for open reading frames. This was done in a program called DNA Strider. It's the type of program that you use for common annotation. All right, so now we're going to look for homologs by taking those open reading frame sequences and doing what we would call a BLAST search. Have you heard of BLAST searches before? Anybody done a BLAST search before? Yes, some of you have. Some have. Anybody not? Everybody's done it. Good. This should be simple there. So then you realize that there are lots of different types of BLAST searches that you can do. There's BLAST N, P, X, and there's some newer material called type of BLAST that's actually CDARC. Right? So one is looking for nucleotide versus nucleotide, protein. BLAST-X actually takes a nucleotide sequence that you put in and translates it in all six frames and then compares that to the database to look for homolog. And then CDART actually will look for conserved domains. So we're learning more and more about certain domain structures that may be important for functions. There may be predictions about the function of a protein that we don't know anything about based on the domain for found. All right, and then, of course, the BLAST algorithm, don't expect you to know this. I just expect you to understand that, obviously, it's very, very complex, and that part of the success of genomics has relied upon the marrying of not only biology or microbiology, but also marrying that to computer science. Right? So many of the things that are done in genomics could never be accomplished without the ability of very talented computer scientists that are able to write programs that can do all of these things without having to do them manually. So just like with the innovations for sequencing, the creation of new technology and dyes, et cetera, required somebody coming up with that technology, we had to have a way to actually analyze it, right? And so computer science has been very instrumental in that. And I think that that reaches across a lot of things. So, point of interest. All right, why don't we take a short break, and then we'll talk about blast output, and then a couple more things, and that'll be it for today. So, 5 or 10 minutes? All right, so once you run a blast, once you run the blast program and get an output, often you get an output that looks something like this. So this is just an example. I blasted something. I wanted to kind of walk you through what it looks like, just remind you, it seems like a lot of you have done it before, but often your output might name look like this. So at the top, you might see that there's a link that shows that you have served domains. So actually, here's a picture it's showing that in this region of the sequence that you put in, that there are predicted conserved domains, phosphatase domains, right? The location of that particular, in this way they've represented it as a blue or a red bar, the location of that bar indicates the location of that domain. So it's saying it's actually in the file, on the free prime end of the sequence, right? That location is important. So a predicted domain is conserved, and then the actual output sequence might look something like this. So the sequence that you put in here, we put in a sequence that's about, looks like about 550 base pairs, so that's represented here in scale, so left to right, 5' to 3', the direction you put it in. And then you'll find that the bars that are below represent the alignments that of the closest homologs of the sequence. So here, the things that are in red represent the things that are the most similar. And once again, the length of the bar is important, and the location of the bar is important. So here, this top one, that's red and runs the entire length, has the highest level of conservation, and is conserved across the entire sequence that you've been, right? On the other hand, the third one down, it shows a high level of conservation, but there's some gaps. It's not conserved on the 5' end, and there's a gap here in the center. The different colors of bars represent different levels of conservation of the sequence or strength of the homology, and that's represented here in this color code. It's above. So red is the highest, so that's what you're hoping for, but also then purple is good, green's not too bad, but you can see that it's conserved and that we have a lot of conservation on the 3'. Right. You get a graphical representation. If you then click on one of those bars, it will take you, or if you click on and scroll down to the entire output, it will take you to something that looks like this. And so these sequence alignments are ordered from top to bottom with the most homology at the top, with decreasing homology as you go down the page. And then you are giving a value, a numerical value, which is all the way to the right, that tells you how good the homology is. So the best homology would be an E value, or what we often call an E value, of basically you get zero. You get zero, basically perfect, identical. But also, an E value of something like this, to minus 52, that's pretty good. It's not zero, but it's minus 52 is not too bad. Right? So the lower the E value, if it's not zero, the lower the E value is that, means the higher the homology. All right, so then you get this large output, and then you can actually decide which ones you want to look at, and then get more detailed information. So I picked one, I think I picked, I don't know which one I picked, but I picked one of them, and depicted here, and I cut it on the next slide. And so it would look like this. Right? So it tells you that the homolog is to a protein tyrosine phosphatase found in Yersinia. It gives you a number that you can actually search in the GenBank to find, pull back information about that specific gene. And usually those are clickable too. You can click and it will take you directly to a page that describes that gene in that order. Right? It gives you some numerical values. Once again, it gives you here is an E value of minus 18. So not the best homolog that we have, but it's decent. It's well below 1. And then you get information about the actual alignment. So there, of the residues that we put in, there were 31% that were identical. So identity would be identical residues. And for similar residues, or positives, we call it 48%. So 48% similarity. What do I mean by similarity?
Similar amino acids?
Right, so between the amino acids. So it means that it may not be exactly the same amino acid, but it's a replacement of an amino acid that's similarly charged or looks a lot. So they're similar amino acids. Right? And then you get, once again, an alignment here below. So the query would be the sequence that you put in, and the subject would be the output. And so here it's actually translated the sequence for us, and the areas of exact homology are shown in the center. So here, this is conserved, these are all identical. The pluses would be similar amino acids. It may be a substitution, but it's at least similar in terms of charge and properties of the different amino acids. So you get alignment that looks like this. Is that clear? Alright, so then in terms of going back to our genome from our bug that we sequenced, so we have to do this for every predicted open reading frame in the organism, right? So depending upon the size of the genome that you've sequenced, you can imagine that this is an enormous amount of work. So once again, this is where computer science has come into play in terms of being able to not only write the algorithms to do the homology searches, but also writing algorithms to automate the process, to actually go in and pull out the sequence based on an open reading frame map and then blast that and then bring the input back. So, and then you having something as a person who's doing the annotation to start with, you don't have to manually do all of that. Right? A lot of this has been streamlined at this point. But still, it's a lot of work if you're doing the annotation, because you can imagine that the smallest bacterial genomes are still pretty big. So the organism that I work with has a very tiny genome, and that's still about 1,600 open reading frames. So that's small. So you have to do that. That the annotation has to be done like that for every open reading frame in there. So what people do is that they do the blast, and then based upon any homology they find, they make a prediction of function. And often they're broken into very general roles. So the common 18 roles that are used, cellular process roles that are depicted here, so find synthesis, cell envelope, and so forth. And so every open reading frame gets assigned one of these functional classes. Right? And then you can do mathematics to ask, well, if you look at the entire genome, how many genes fall into each functional group, and then what's the percentage out of the total genome? And so that can tell you something about the makeup and how important certain classes of genes may be in the life cycle of the organism. So if you can also represent this diagrammatically, and this is often done, by taking those individual classes that we just looked at, they're just given a numerical value, and then you can put this into basically a pie. And so you can ask what types or classes of genes are most represented in the genome. And so I think that what you'll find is that if you look at any genomic sequences out there, the two largest classes are always 9 and 10. What do you think 9 and 10 are?
Well, it just said conserved proteins for 9 and 10 is unknown.
Right, so it's conserved, hypothetical, and unknown. So basically, the two most common classes are things that we don't have any clue what the heck they do, that if there's a homolog in some other organism that we don't have any clue what the heck it does, or it's unique to this organism. There's no homology in the data. Right? So for every genomic sequence that's out there, these are the two most common classes. Right? There are very few exceptions. Some of the organisms, like some of the chlamydia, have very, very small genome for anything in excess from the leader. These may not be the largest classes, but broadly they are. Right? So once again, highlighting the fact that not only can't we culture very many organisms, not only don't we know about very many genes, just having the sequence doesn't necessarily tell us anything. Right? So there are lots of predicted genes that we don't have any clue what they do. And also you have to keep in mind that when you look at these annotations, that just because whoever annotated the genome said, well, the most homology is to an amino acid biosynthesis cluster, that actually doesn't say that functionally that that's what the protein is going to do, right? Right? So number one, just because there's an ORF doesn't mean that ORF is expressed, doesn't mean there's protein ever made. And if there is, just because it's a homolog by sequence doesn't mean that functionally it's the same. Right? So those things have to be proven. And I think often people forget about that. You often see annotations depicted in circular maps like this. So this is actually a genomic map of Vibrio cholerae. So the Vibrio species all have two chromosomes rather than one. So they have a large and a small chromosome. And so in this case, each of the individual circles of material represents something else. It's very common to see these types of maps. Right? And here it says they're outside inward, first and second circle predicted protein regions, on plus and minus strand, by role, so using those classification systems we just looked at. And here they've assigned each one of them a color. Right? So you get very detailed predictions of the entire genome of the organism. And so these types of maps are very common. All right, so obviously this provides a huge amount of data. Has allowed us to actually do high throughput sequencing, to sequence lots of organisms, lots more data. And also to has led to new technologies, and we'll talk about some of these technologies in the next lecture, like microarrays and actually functional genomics, changing the way science is done, the way science is designed. And I say here at the bottom is that, you know, the old method that people did science was to look for a phenotype and then ask, well, what's the gene that's responsible for the phenotype? Whereas today, it's quite common just to look through a genomic sequence and say, well, I'm interested in that gene. Let's mutate it and see what happens. So in some ways, the experimental design over the course of the last 10 years has changed from phenotype to genotype to phenotype to phenotype. And so it's actually quite controversial in science in terms of whether or not that's necessarily a good thing. Some people think it is, some people think it's not. And I don't know if there's a right or wrong answer to that, but something maybe for you to think about as you read both newer and older papers and think about the way you design experiments and how you go about conducting your own research. And often you'll find also in, once again, thinking about how this is used, that you'll find that a lot of experiments now are very broad. So you do a microarray to look at the expression of every gene in the organism. You're not going to look at or a lot of people wouldn't look at 2022 genes. At least start for something like that. So it's really flawed in science. And as I said, it influences how you ask questions. So once again, I think it's a very controversial topic in science. Some people really like genomics, some people aren't, because they favor it. All right, one thing that's been, we should have to think about is there's some terminology. So all of these types of genomic sequences that are being developed, we're going to group organisms together. There's some terminology I want you to think about and to make sure you understand. So part of this we can use to actually think about evolution of genes and how they're distributed among different organisms. And so we talked about we're going to look for homologs, right? So a homolog is actually defined down here at the bottom. So it's a gene that's similar in structure and origin to a gene in another species. So it looks similar to structure. But that doesn't necessarily say anything about function, right? So homologs may not be functionally related. So genes that are functionally related are called orthologs. So here you've got bug A and bug B, and you've got X1 in both of them. And so these two are orthologs, because they are functionally the same. You can also get evolution of genes within a single organism. So this gene could be duplicated. If you had two copies, you can imagine that they could evolve, right? And they could evolve into what we would call paralogs. Alright, so they are, basically it's two genes in the same organism that may or may not have the same function, but evolutionarily they're related. So orthologs have the same function, paralogs likely don't, but they're found in the same organism. Orthologs being different organisms than homologs, just as they look alike. So then would some, if I told you that X1 from bug A and bug B were orthologs, would they also be homologs? Yep, yeah, not necessarily. We've got a head shake yes over there. So actually they would. So homologs is a broad term, right? So if something is homolog, then it's either going to be an orthologue or a paralog, right? So homologue would be the group that catches all. Right? So it's a broad term. So just because two genes are homologous doesn't mean that they're orthologous. But they either have to be orthologs or paralogs among them, right? Because there's a reason that they're actually showing homology to each other. Okay. In terms of the other type of information you can get, and when you go back to the CMR and start playing around in the database, you'll find some of this, is that you can actually make predictions about proteins that are going to be encoded in the organism. And so here is an image of what we call a pseudo 2D gel. It's a 2D gel, two-dimensional gel. Right, so it's where you separate proteins by both size and charge, and more specifically, charge is, say, isoelectric focus. What's an isoelectric focus? Right, so it's the pH of which the charge of the protein is. So that's where it's soft migrating. Okay. So then you can basically take all of the open reading frames in an organism, figure out what size protein should be encoded, and what the predicted charge would be based on the amino acid content, and then you can make predictions about, well, those protein hybrids are going to go. You can also ask about the GC content of particular regions of the genome or particular genes. And that's often depicted in this way, where basically they're showing the percent GC here on the left, and then they're showing the kilobases of DNA sequence. And so you can see that you get some fluctuations. And that the average here is 37.34% GC. Why would you ever care about this? Okay, that's right. And so why would GC tell you that? Right. So you're right. You're both right. So it helps us predict whether or not there are large segments of genes that came from other regions, and that's due to the fact that different organisms have very different GC content. So it's easy to look and say, well, look, there's this huge spike that's quite different, so perhaps that's a region of DNA that isn't from this organism and is acquired by horizontal gene transfer. You can also do hydrophobicity plots. Have you folks talked about those before? Hydrophobicity plots. So basically here, we've got our protein depicted linearly, and we've got a GES scale installed to hydrophobic regions, which we predict to be at the top and hydrophilic at the bottom. What does this tell us? So if I showed you this hydrophobicity plot, what would you say? Just say anything about the protein that's in total? Okay. What would you expect to see with a strengthened? Would you think this was strengthened or not? Probably not. So this is probably a cytoplasmic protein because it has no hydrophobic structures. So it was a transmembrane protein, and it had transmembrane structures, so it actually be important in starting it. That's not familiar to anybody to watch it. You can also make predictions about secondary structure, or how the amino acids are going to fold, so how you're going to get structure. And so here we're showing helix, coils, and strands. This is important because different structures often are important for different domains. So for instance, DNA binding domains for regulatory proteins are often a helix turn helix domain. And so knowing that, oh, structurally I have a helix turn helix might indicate to you that, well, maybe this is a regulatory protein that interacts with DNA. So knowing something about the predicted structure of your protein can tell you possibly something about its function. You can also do very broad comparisons between your genomes. Right? So for instance, here is a region of DNA and predicted open reading frames from a number of related organisms. So here's H. pylori 26695, which is one strain, J99 is a different strain, right? And what you can see is that if you look, that there's not complete conservation even among the strains, right? So there's a small open reading frame found in this strain that's not in this one. There's a gene here that's in the same location that looks like it has completely different function between, and you can tell that by the different colors. You can see that there's larger gaps, etc. So you can make predictions about the relatedness of different organisms based upon the conservation. You then go to another Helicobacter where you find, once again, that there are more insertions, changes in function of genes, etc. So you can say something about evolution of different bacteria over time. You can make predictions about what evolved from what or how they evolved related, based upon the orientation of each of these in the conservation. Have you heard the word sentient before? extension. So if word genes are in a syntonic arrangement, that means they're arranged in the same order. So it has to do with the order of the genes in the chromosome, essentially. So if you then take the organisms that have been sequenced and ask, are there any trends in terms of the content there, what we find is that if we ask what percentage of the genome is predicted to actually encode for proteins versus the number of sequenced organisms, what we find is that for the bacteria and archaea, most of their genomic content is actually predicted to encode for protein, as opposed to eukaryotic organisms like humans or mice, etc., which have introns, exons, right? So not everything is actually encoding for material. So we often say that prokaryotic genomes are actually very tightly packed. There's not a lot of wasted space, so there's not a lot of non-transcribed, translated region. Most of it is actually coding sequence. And that's pretty much universal, I think, for all the sequences of prokaryotes that have been made. So they're very tightly packed. Those have been encoded or is predicted to encode. Also, something that's become evident is the fact that the genome size of any particular organism is affected by the niche that it lives in. So if we look at organisms that are free living, and they actually made some here, they put some of these as opportunistic pathogens. So things like E. coli, Salmonella, different bacillus, which you're going to find broadly all over the place on skin, soil, different environments, they tend to have much larger genomes than something, say, like Chlamydia, which is an obligate intracellular pathogen, so it won't grow out of the environment. Right? So basically, it tells us the bacteria become specialized. So once they've established in a niche, they tend to lose genes that aren't required for survival in that niche, and then they basically become stuck there. So they can't grow out the environment if they lose that environment. All right, so the size of the genome might help make predictions about whether or not you would expect an organism to be found in lots of different environments. All right, and so then if you think very broadly about what this means and thinking about organisms, it suggests that, once again, genomes are in flux, right? You can see size and changes in the size. And you have to think about the fact that, since, as we said, that the bulk of prokaryotic sequence is actually predicted to be coding sequence, is that if you change even a small region, you've probably affected gene content, right? You probably deleted your genes. That means you've deleted a function of your genome. And so what comes or goes, if you're either deleting or taking in material, is important for shaping the life cycle of the bacteria. And it means that the larger the genome, probably the more biochemical pathways you encode, and as I said, the ability to live in different environments. All right. In terms of thinking about how variability occurs, you mentioned the fact that you can acquire different genes, and we call that horizontal gene transfer, right? And so you remember that often horizontal gene transfer occurs by either transduction, transformation, or conjugation, as you know, the three ways that DNA come into an organism. But then in terms of thinking about how is that piece of DNA maintained, there are some things that either have to happen, right? So either it has to be on an episome, it has to be on a plasmid that's able to replicate, it has to recombine into the chromosome, homologous recombination, or maybe illegitimate recombination, has to get in there some way, or has to integrate. And of course, the examples are like phage and insertion sequences, right? So it can't exist, it's not just linear DNA in the chromosome. It's landscape we look to replicate can be maintained in some way. And then if you think about these different things related to horizontal gene transfer, you can use some of that to actually think about phenotypes and distribution, all right? So often, horizontal gene transfers will occur late in evolution of different bacterial species, right? So it might actually differentiate one type of Salmonella, for instance, Salmonella typhimurium, into a different type of Salmonella because they've acquired a piece of foreign DNA that gives them the ability, right? And I'll show you an example of this. We'll actually talk about deliberative tolerance in a second, right? These loci are more than likely going to encode new traits that the organism didn't have. And if they don't encode new traits, probably not going to be kept. So you're not going to carry around excess DNA that's not beneficial for you. Because we talked about the fact that genomes shrink in size when the organism become more specialized. So that says that they don't want to have anything extra. We already talked about AT richness and codon usage as being important. So a perfect example of how horizontal gene transfer can occur is if we think about deliberative tolerance. So this is a partial, let's say, classic depiction of regulation and virulence in deliberative tolerance. So it's a lot more complex than this, but the important points that we want to talk about here. So Vibrio cholerae is a pathogen due to the acquisition of not just one, but two pieces of foreign DNA. So if you look in the environment, there are lots of Vibrio species that are Vibrio cholerae that are actually not pathogenic. They're not able to be virulent. And that's because they lack these pieces of DNA. So the first one of those is a cluster of genes called the VPI, the Vibrio pathogenicity island, right? And that encodes a large number of genes, 20-some genes. But the very important thing that's encoded here is a cluster of genes that actually encodes for the toxin co-regulated pilus. And that pilus is absolutely essential for colonization of Vibrio inside of the human host. So if you don't have that, you don't colonize well, and then therefore you don't cause disease. And so this is clearly a pathogenicity island. It's acquired by horizontal gene transfer. The GC content is quite different from the rest of the organism. So for Vibrio to become a pathogen, it had to acquire this island. The next step in terms of that evolution has to do with the acquisition of a phage called the CTX phage, so CTX AB. And that phage, once again, is integrated in the chromosome, so it's a lysogenic phage, and it encodes the cholera toxin. So the reason I say that this had to be a stepwise acquisition is the fact that this phage actually uses the pilus that's encoded on this island as its receptor for binding and entry into the cell. Right? So for Vibrio to become a pathogen, it had to first acquire the island, and then the components encoded on that island were important for acquiring the phage. Right? So that's an example of how we can use the presence of horizontally acquired material to think about evolution of different bacteria and bacterial species. This slide is meant to show that if you look at chromosomes broadly, that horizontal gene transfer is very common. So you can see that there are insertion elements, predicted phage elements, etc., that pretty much span a lot of the genomes. And so that says that horizontal gene transfer probably actually occurs quite often. And it's in very diverse organisms, everything from just basic E. coli The helicobacter, which is obviously more specialized, the other thing that works in the stomach, to the PETSI, et cetera. So very, very common. And so then in thinking broadly, the genomes are going to be mosaics of both ancestral and acquired genes. The components are probably bacteria actually sample DNA around them often, with the idea that it might make them more if they acquire new factors. And we talked about the fact that genetic elements are involved, and for that piece of DNA to be maintained, it has to have some benefit, right? So they don't carry around things they don't need. Also, you'll hear more later, we'll talk about the loss of genes. So we most often talk about acquiring genes as getting some new traits for bacterium being beneficial. But there are cases where bacteria have actually lost genes, and that's become beneficial. So that phenomenon actually was described by Dr. Morelli's group, and it's called black holes. So their group has shown that the loss of certain genes has led to Shigella being able to be a pathogen. So we have to think not only about gain of function, but also loss of function as being important for evolution of bacteria. Right, and if you think about deletions, these, of course, are really a committed step. Once you've deleted a gene, you can't change your mind, right? So it's not reversible. Unlike the acquisition, you can acquire a gene and then say you don't want it to get rid of it. But here, if you delete, that's committed, right? And obviously, deletions can't involve essential loci, right? It has to be things that aren't going to be important for survival. And the essentiality of different genes depends upon what the bacteria are getting, right? So, think about that. So, environment's important. Here's that word synteny I was talking about. So, synteny, gene order, the way that organized in the genome. Right, and then we can think about whether or not why would bacteria choose to delete genes from their genome, right? So there was this question about whether or not this is actually beneficial. Is there a benefit to actually having a small genome for an organism? And so there have been a number of studies, which I'm not going to go through any of the details of this, but there have been a number of studies that are taking related organisms and trying to determine what's been deleted over time and whether or not that confers any benefits. So these are the types of very broad studies that are being conducted using genomic tools. All right, so here's like a basic reconstruction of this small region of Bucknera and what they think the ancestor looked like. It has been shown that if you take organisms and you might predict that an organism with a small genome might actually replicate faster, so that could be a benefit, but that turns out not to be true. So you can calculate doubling time based upon the size of the genome, and organisms with smaller genomes don't seem to have any real benefit over ones with larger genomes. Okay. So it's probably not necessarily beneficial for the organism to have a really tiny genome in terms of any of the phenotypes that we've been able to isolate and look at. All right, so that's all summarized here. No real advantage. Often you're committed, so if you delete genes while you're in a niche, you're stuck there. And living in a environment might supply the pressure that's needed to lead to deletion of factors. All right, and so this is just a summary of all of that. So you can either get increase or decrease in genes by either acquisition or duplication of genes in the chromosome. You can lose fragments, and you can get the formation of pseudogenes. So those are genes they look like genes from the chromosome, but they have some kind of mutation that probably inactivates them. Leads to a premature stop codon or an inactive mutation, pseudogene. And then you can also see after that deletion of the pseudogene. Okay. So lots of ways to modify. So once again, don't forget to check out the CMR pages and play around and see the kinds of tools that are out there for genomic research. And we'll stop there. Any questions? All right, good luck on the exam.